We are speaking to you from LaGuardia Field, New York. Our NBC Mobile unit is standing on runway 31. Poised at the end of the runway is the Army's P-80 jet propulsion plane, the Shooting Star. Today, the P-80 will attempt a new speed record from New York to Washington within the time limits of this program. There is the takeoff.
This is the NA-8 official timer at LaGuardia Airfield, calling National Airfield, Washington. The official time of the takeoff was 3:59.
Stand by, Washington.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, April 21st, 1946, we present the 23rd in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
the Army Air Forces on wings of the future.
This is Robert St. John in New York. Winging its way south at this very moment is one of the greatest engineering miracles to come out of the war. The Army Air Forces jet-propelled P-80. The Shooting Star, which you heard take off from LaGuardia Field only a moment ago. Down at the National Airport in Washington, the National Aeronautical Association's official timers are on hand to clock this historic flight as the Shooting Star, piloted by Captain Martin Smith, attempts to break the current New York to Washington record of 58 minutes.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. Many other miracles of flight are being studied and developed by the United States Army Air Forces. And here with me are two men who will later tell us something of what lies ahead in the field of flight. Commanding General of the Army Air Forces, Carl Spotts, and Major General Curtis LeMay. We are standing by.
In the victory over Japan and Germany, air power played a decisive role. Our flying personnel fought magnificently, and we had by far the largest air fleet.
Mr. St. John.
Yes, Doctor.
What you say is absolutely true. But I wonder how many people realize that at the war's end, we did not have the most efficient fighting planes. We had no machines, for example, that could equal the speed of German jet-propelled planes. Nor had we any defense whatever against the V-2 rocket.
Well, of course, you're right, Doctor. The point you make is crucial to any discussion of air warfare. Our victory was won by, well, what we can call muscle power. By sheer weight of numbers, we prevented Germany from producing her new flying devices in any kind of meaningful quantity.
Exactly. And in discussing any air war of the future, these facts of history are vital. Germany outpaced us in jet aircraft, jet propulsion, and rocket weapons.
Say, Doctor, mind clearing one thing up for me?
What's that, young man?
Well, the way I heard it, we spent a carload of dough on planes ourselves. Now, how come we didn't have jet planes?
Partly because we spent that carload of money all at once, after war had caught up with us. Some of it should have gone for research back in peacetime.
But they did plenty of research, I know that, out at Wright Field.
Well, not compared to Germany. Besides, Wright Field is primarily for the development of new ideas. The pure research that must precede development has been done mostly in our universities and by private firms.
And Germany?
Germany literally poured her money and brains into the hunt for new weapons. They produced jet aircraft in 1944. But how long before that do you suppose the plans for jet must have been on the drawing boards?
Oh, no, I don't know how long.
At least 10 years.
I'd like to point out something else. General LeMay down here says we were primarily interested in big bombers and long-range fighters. They are what we needed to win. We concentrated on them, and no country came close to matching what we produced. Our P-51 fighter planes had the Germans goggle-eyed. The Germans, on the other hand, were interested in other types of aircraft, and what they had was a jolt to us when we saw them up close. They had flying machines in actual combat that were still in the blueprint stage over here. We blinked our eyes for a minute, we sat down, and we got to work fast. We took the best of the German ideas, added them to our own, and came up with new, efficient weapons.
One of those new weapons carried us into a brand new field, the field of jet-propelled aircraft. Just such a plane as the P-80 or Shooting Star, which you heard leaving LaGuardia Airfield at the start of this program to try for a new speed record between here and Washington. This plane does not use a gasoline engine. It is not propeller-driven at all. Now, perhaps, Doctor, you'd be good enough to explain the principle it uses.
The jet plane is propelled by the thrust of gases vented from the rear of the plane. These gases are generated in an engine within the plane by burning fuel under great pressure. The action is similar to the flight of an inflated toy balloon when the air is permitted to escape rapidly.
Thank you, Doctor. Well, that's how the Shooting Star works. What she looks like, well, that's another matter. But we have a real treat in store for you this afternoon. You are about to hear this handsome creature, Shooting Star, describe herself.
How do you do, Mr. St. John?
Welcome, Shooting Star. Now then, would you be averse to describing yourself?
Not in the least. I look a little bit like a fighter plane, except that I have no ugly propeller in front. My pilot sits under a molded glass bubble. These oval objects on my wingtips are fuel tanks. I drop them in flight when they're empty. My fuselage curves gracefully up to my wings. Don't you think so, Mr. St. John?
Yes, indeed.
My skin is painted a beautiful French gray.
And what's your diet, Miss Star?
I live entirely on kerosene and air.
And your speed?
Of polenta.
Yes, it looks like jet-propelled airplanes are going to be very, very popular. Their lightning speed, their simple design, gives them a head start over the conventional gasoline engine. Already they approach the speed of sound. One type, the ramjet, may within our time reach the unheard-of speed of 3,000 miles per hour.
Yes, but the jet plane doesn't have the field entirely to itself. Already there is competition from a new type of airplane that may someday overshadow the Shooting Star. A plane that also can attain a speed of 3,000 miles an hour. It's the German V-2, and it lifted the curtain on a new kind of aerial warfare, rocket warfare. A giant tube, 45 feet long, with a ton of high explosive in its warhead, it dropped out of the stratosphere to blast in the age of supersonic flight, or flight at speeds greater than that of sound.
The rocket is propelled in much the same manner as the jet plane, but the method of achieving that propulsion is quite different. The jet engine uses the outside atmosphere to mix with its fuel for combustion. The rocket carries its air in tanks within the missile. Since it is independent of outside air, it can fly at great heights where the atmosphere is too thin to support engine combustion.
These war-borne jet planes and rockets pose entirely new concepts in the field of flight. In one swoop, they make technically obsolete our entire Air Force as it was at the end of the war. They substitute series of question marks. And here at our National Hour microphone is the man who must prepare and direct the research necessary to deal with these new concepts of supersonic flight. Major General Curtis LeMay, in charge of research and development for the Army Air Forces. General LeMay, how will the Air Forces meet this challenge?
In this new era of supersonic speeds, we have many serious problems. We know what some of these problems are, but their solutions at the present time are entirely hypothetical. No doubt we shall run into difficulties we can't foresee. Our problems may not work out precisely as you will hear them on this program, but their range will not be exaggerated. And what you hear will prove that we must attack them with imagination, boldness, and all the skill and manpower available. During the last war, the Army Air Forces had to use most of our basic aeronautical research facilities to develop bombers and fighters. After the collapse of Germany, we found that this action had placed air power years behind in some phases of fundamental research, such as supersonics, fluid dynamics, and jet propulsion. We must never allow our fundamental research to lag behind again. We must catch up now. To make certain we do, we propose an Army Air Forces Engineering Development Center. We depend on our civilian organizations, such as universities and industries, for much of our research and development. However, they need tools, and these tools are too expensive for any private organization to buy, so the government must furnish them. Thus, this center will be in the nature of a nationwide community tool chest. Anyone interested in the development of air power will be allowed the full use of these tools. The Army Air Forces and a scientific board representing the people of America will monitor this center. They will determine the priority of projects and guide research and development from one period to another. We have no time to lose. We are entering a new age. We need these facilities now. The cost and money will be great, but as you will hear, the only way we can develop air power so necessary for a world of peace and national security is through a realistic research and development program.
Thank you, General LeMay.
When German jet-propelled planes appeared during the last stages of the war in Europe, it was clear, as we've pointed out, that German aeronautical research had gone far beyond our own. But just how far and in what specific ways, we didn't know until the end of hostilities permitted us to examine the Nazi Air Force closely. One day, two GIs assigned to policing duty near the German village of Ottobrunn came upon an object that puzzled them considerably.
Hey, Joe, get a load of that, will you?
Come on, we're looking for souvenirs. Yeah, it looks just like something from Coney Island.
Yeah, Cave of the Winds or something. Some building. That must be that new Nazi architecture.
Funny-looking thing. Looks like a couple of funnels laid end-to-end. Small in the middle and big at the ends, yeah?
The hourglass figure.
I'll ask this guy what it is. Hey, Landsman, do you know what that thing is?
Yeah. It so happens I was employed in what you call that thing.
Is that a fact?
Well, what kind of work can you do in a pair of funnels?
Funnels? Funnels? What are those? This is a wind tunnel.
A wind tunnel?
Oh, for testing airplanes and stuff?
Yeah, the most powerful wind tunnel in the world. Better than any you have in America.
We dismantled that great wind tunnel capable of 7,500 mile-an-hour wind speeds, brought the mechanical parts back to the United States. It will be set up at Wright Field to help unlock the secrets of supersonics.
But even aided by German instruments, the present facilities of our Air Force are woefully inadequate to the new problems raised by supersonic flight. One of the answers to the need may be the vast air research center described by General LeMay. What, then, are some of the problems which this center of concentrated research activity would tackle? What problems specifically do airmen face in their projected plans to build planes that will fly faster than the speed of sound?
You ask me why we need a research center, gentlemen. Well, I'll tell you. The terrific speed possible with jet planes and rockets pose problems we have never before had to face. We don't at this moment know what effect these speeds will have on men and machines. As we approach the speed of sound, roughly 760 miles an hour, strange things begin to happen. Very strange things.
Well, there's
And since it's impossible to experiment in the air with human beings, the experiment can only be done in wind tunnels using model planes.
But don't you have wind tunnels out at Wright Field, General?
None that can produce more than a 700-mile blast.
Just what can you do with a wind tunnel, sir?
Well, Colonel, this is your field. Will you answer that question?
Yes. Wind tunnels help us resolve the difficulties of supersonic flight. You see, a plane in flight pushes the air ahead of it into a definite pattern. At very high speeds, the air, having had less time to start flowing before the plane catches up with it, is compressed and piles up in front of the plane almost like a solid mass. Now, to get through this solid mass is the problem. The danger point for planes is about 600 miles an hour. There we pass from the known to the unknown.
Thank you, Colonel.
Assuming you get your wind tunnels, General, what else would this proposed research center contain?
Well, we shall need at least one concrete testing pit for rockets.
Well, do you think, General, that rockets will be used enough in the future to justify all this testing?
Someday, gentlemen, we shall have piloted rockets, spaceships flown high above the Earth carrying humans. And these humans will be subject to new conditions.
New conditions? What kind?
Violent temperature changes, for one thing.
You see, up to 23 miles above the Earth, the temperature is about 67 degrees below zero.
But a few miles further up, it becomes unbearably hot. The temperature registers 350 degrees of heat, enough to melt solder.
Or kill a man.
Right. But heat could be kept out by making the cabin into a sort of enlarged vacuum bottle.
The main difficulty will be the lack of atmosphere to equalize the temperature. Here on Earth, it is only slightly cooler in the shade of a tree, for example, than out in the direct sunlight. But 50 miles in the sky, it is boiling hot in the direct sunlight. And cold, cold beyond human understanding in the shade.
You see the difficulty there, gentlemen? The side of the rocket facing the sun would glow with heat. The shady underside might become a sheet of ice.
If temperature were the only problem, we could sustain life very well in rockets 50 miles up. But human life is fragile. A test flight might reveal other difficulties.
Hurry up, Ruth. The spaceship is landing.
Where is it?
Over there. Come on, come on, right through this crowd now. Oh, excuse me, mister.
Oh, sir.
Excuse me, please.
Why, sure.
Oh, isn't it big?
Well, it has to be big to fly 100 miles high.
They're unsealing the door.
There's three men in it, the paper said. Three men attempt desperate climb into outer space. That's what it said.
They got the door open.
Can you see in? What's the matter with her?
All right, what's the matter with that woman?
She saw something inside.
Get a doctor, quick.
Yeah, get a doctor.
I don't know for sure. Radioactive rays, perhaps. X-rays from the sun.
Yes, but the sun shines down here too, Doc.
Yes, but we've got air down here to absorb harmful rays. Don't forget that. In the upper atmosphere, there isn't any oxygen.
As you see, stratosphere flying has some unknown elements. And still another thing we shall have to study is atomic power.
Atomic power? Are we that far advanced?
Well, if you mean, are we near to using nuclear power, no. But obviously, atomic energy offers many possibilities for use by flying machines. Rockets, for example, might very well use it. At present, it's difficult to send rockets higher than 100 miles or so, because they cannot carry enough fuel. But atomic power consumes very little space, that we know. And its use for rocket flight is ideal.
Still, the use of atomic power seems so far in the future, General.
Perhaps. But let no man forget that we had just that attitude toward jet propulsion when it was first started by the Germans. Yes,
a few years ago, rocket warfare was strictly in the realm of fantasy. And then the V-2 fell on London. The future which is ahead could bring a rocket powerful enough to cross the oceans and the continents. The specter of such a missile, guided to America by radio waves and carrying an atom bomb, can no longer be dismissed.
Well, the defense now being developed by the Army Air Forces against possible atomic bomb attack by rocket is, of course, a top-drawer military secret. We can only conjecture as to what it might be, but here is one picture, a wholly imaginary one, of what might be done. The scene is a rocket-launching site thousands of miles from the United States. It's hidden in the earth, deep down an endless flight of stone steps.
Quiet, please! Quiet! I have orders from the Chief of Staff. Proceed against Objective R at 2 a.m. Tuesday. Quiet! Quiet!
We have but 4 minutes, Captain.
That is enough. Here's the chart. This is Objective R here.
New York City?
Yes. It is the nerve center of the whole country. Here are your computations.
51 degrees, azimuth R minus 1.
Here is the flight line of the missile. The point of highest trajectory, 210 miles, will be over the ocean, this spot. From there, it will begin its descent.
Well, how long will it take to reach New York, Captain?
40 minutes. 40 minutes. It will be rubble. Our air troops will seize it before they can defend themselves. Victory in 36 hours.
Ready, sir.
Huh? Oh, yes. Adjust the flight angle, Sergeant.
Flight angle set, sir. 51 degrees, azimuth R, minus 1.
Close chamber. Fire rocket.
As the rocket climbs skyward at 3,000 miles an hour, another group of men, personnel of the Army Air Forces, sit in a radar station somewhere on this continent. They're watching a small illuminated screen on which flying airplanes are shown as pinpoints of light.
Oh, boy, am I sleepy.
Oh, you and me both. What a night.
Hey.
What?
See that? There's us again.
I don't see it. Oh, holy mackerel, look at that. What's going like lightning?
There's no scheduled flight in that sector tonight.
It's coming towards us fast. Operator, connect with countermeasure station. Quick.
Yes, sir.
A short distance away at the countermeasure station, a rocket is readied for launching. Once in the air, this rocket, flying by radio control, will seek out and attempt to destroy the enemy rocket. Its course will be constantly corrected by information received from the radar screen.
Is the proximity fuse set?
Yes, sir.
Check computation.
A41 by J347.
Correct. Fire rocket.
Swiftly, the rocket climbs up through the stratosphere, 50 miles, 100, 200 miles above the Earth, and it hurls itself against the enemy rocket. No human eye can see them as they approach. No human ear can hear them. No human mind can comprehend the awesome force as they crash.
Here at our National Hour microphone in Washington is the man who can tell us better than anyone else how the Air Forces expect to fulfill their fast-expanding role in national defense. The man who directs the wings of the future, Commanding General of the Air Forces, Carl Spotts. General Spotts.
What you've heard is not far-fetched. The areas opened to us by jet and rocket propulsion is an aerial wilderness in which we cannot afford ever to get lost, and through which only science can guide us. But we must not be completely absorbed by this fantastic future. We have other problems we must tackle immediately. Our B-29s and our long-range fighters, such as the P-51, such planes as these are, right now, the world's greatest weapons of war, and we must keep improving them even while we look into brand new fields. We have new and better orthodox bombers, new and better fighters, now being tested and designed. We must pursue this development and go on to still better planes of standard types. We cannot ignore them, waiting for the jet craft to make them obsolete. we must never again be caught lagging in any branch of air development. The airplane is now our first bulwark of defense. The air forces are responsible for that defense. Our development and research should be carefully concentrated. It would be a tragic mistake to disperse our scientific efforts in several uncoordinated directions. We can never get maximum strength by dividing our energies. So they should be concentrated where the responsibility lies. That's one step in maintaining an air defense as fine as any that can be devised. But there's an even more fundamental requirement. We must have the people of America behind us. Our scientific progress will be only as good as the people want it to be. Only if the nation is science-minded, if the nation appreciates the value of both fundamental research and development, can we get ahead and stay ahead.
Thank you, General Spots. And now to the National Airport down here to get the latest word on that P-80 that took off from New York at the start of this program. Come in, National Airport.
We are speaking to you from the control tower at the National Airport in Washington. In just a few minutes, we expect to catch sight of the Army P-80 jet fighter as it swings across the Potomac. Inside our tower here, we've heard from the pilot of the record-busting jet plane when he was 6 minutes out of Washington. He will cross the finish line, the line between our tower and the Washington Monument, at about 1,000 feet. The old record for the flight between New York and Washington was established in 1938 when Alexander de Seversky flew the route in 58 minutes and 38 seconds. The commercial flying time between the two points by airliner is about 1 hour and a half. By train, it's about a four-hour trip. Three official timers of the National Aeronautic Association are here to take the official timing of the flight. They will submit their data to the NAA contest board, which will certify the flight as a national intercity record under the rules of the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, or FAI, the international governing body for aircraft performance records. It's a clear day in Washington with unlimited visibility. At 1,000 feet, the altitude of the imaginary finish line, our jet plane has an 8-mile tailwind. Our imaginary finish line is the line drawn from the control tower here at the National Airport to the Washington Monument, I should say about 2 miles away. Our jet plane hasn't yet put in an appearance, but we're gathered here at the tower watching for it. Across the Potomac, which is at the moment dotted with a number of sailboats, there's a boat from the Naval Gun Factory progressing downstream. And at the moment, the National Airport is very quiet. The roar of planes that you hear continually out here has quieted. Everybody is standing around, looking off toward Baltimore, where our plane was a few moments ago. But as yet, he hasn't put in an appearance, and we're hoping very much that he's going to be able to get here before we have to go off the air. Can we hear this contact between the plane and the tower? He's getting closer, but as yet, we haven't seen him. Our official timers are gathered around inside the tower, and our position here is on the railing just outside, about 50 feet above the tarmac of the airport, which is very quiet, no engines, no planes, and here he comes. He's over the Naval Gun Factory about 6 or 8 miles away. I can't... 800 feet. I can't quite see him. He's getting very close. There he comes. He looks like a comet. He's coming in right over our heads here. There's a trail of smoke coming out behind him. It's going to be awfully close. There he goes. Let's see if we can pick up the noise. Here he comes. And there he goes. And if we can give you the time, we've only got a second or two before we go off the air. I'm afraid not. I'm back to the National Hour.
On the subject of the Army Air Force's Operation Future, then, our documentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen to the National Hour again next Sunday when our subject will be Ships to Sea, the Future of Our Merchant Marine.
This has been the National Hour. From its studios in New York and Washington, and from mobile units at New York's LaGuardia Airport and Washington's National Airport, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 23rd of its series on current affairs and national problems. Our speakers today were General Carl Spatz and Major General Curtis Ely May. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. Daylight saving time goes into effect in certain areas next Sunday. This means that the National Hour will be heard at a different time in your community, and it may be heard at that time. Please check your local paper for time at which this program will be heard next week and every week thereafter. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.